I am Matt Welch, joined by Nick Gillespie, Peter Suderman, Catherine Mangue Ward. Hello, Walking Wounded.
Howdy.
Hey, Matt.
Happy Monday.
we're going to talk.
Wait, it's not Monday, is it?
It's not. It's sorry. Tuesday.
Happy Tuesday.
0 for 2 already. We're going to talk about Joe Biden's 51st and quite lousiest week as president of these United States here in a moment. But first, I am here to introduce you all to a groovy new podcast called The Long Time Academy. The Long Time Academy podcast literally delivers on its title. It's about time and how we think about time and how we should maybe train ourselves to think more long term. Plus, it has some actual lessons and exercises to help reorient your mental approach. God knows some of us need that. Ask yourself this question. How can you, Nick Gillespie, be a better ancestor? Think about it. You will hear wisdom from people such as Brian Eno, Celeste Headlee, George the Poet, Jay Griffiths, and Alua Arthur. Live life better by confronting your own mortality even more than you already do. Get off the treadmill of short-term thinking. Search for The Long Time Academy anywhere you listen to podcasts. Life is short. Time is long. The Long Time Academy. Download it today. You'll be glad you did. Okay, let's review. Joe Biden went down to Georgia last week to deliver a table pounder of a speech about voting rights, and he couldn't even get Georgia voting rights queen Stacey Abrams to show up. In the speech, the president, who came into office promising to lower the temperature after the last chaotic 4 years of American life, referred to Republican efforts to change voting laws in Georgia and elsewhere as Jim Crow 2.0. He also tweeted that this very morning on Tuesday, adding in the speech helpfully, "This is not hyperbole, this is fact. The threat to our democracy is so grave," the president continued, "that it was now time to scrap the Senate's filibuster rule so that Democrats can pass their preferred voting-related legislation and anything else they want on a party-line 51-50 vote." His conclusion: "The next few days, when these bills come to a vote, will mark a turning point in this nation's history. Will we choose democracy over autocracy, light over shadows, justice, Peter Suderman, over injustice?" Well,
did he say Peter Suderman?
He did.
In the speech?
He did. He was doing a lot of like off script, little ad libs. By that definition of Biden's own definition, we apparently chose autocracy within 48 hours, as Democratic senators Kyrsten Sinema and Joe Manchin reiterated for the kajillionth time that they are not going to vote to change filibuster rules in the United States Senate. Senate Democrats this week will nevertheless persist in voting on these bills that will almost certainly fail. Meanwhile, Biden's approval ratings continue to burble southward in the low 40s. He's basically the second least popular president in the modern polling era, getting pretty close to Donald Trump, who was the least popular. And perhaps more strikingly, Gallup yesterday announced that over the past 12 months, we have seen one of the largest shifts in party self-identification, largest one-year shifts in recorded history, where self-identified Democrats and Republicans and leaners, when you measure them together, a year ago it was 49-40 Democrats, and now it is 47-42 for Republicans, a rare Republican lead. Also, Biden's vaccine mandate on employers via OSHA got shut down by the Supreme Court last week. Bad week for Joe Biden. Catherine, what does your sexy American girlfriend, Kyrsten Sinema, and I'm going to pronounce her first name differently every time.
You're just going to choose a random name.
Exactly. What does she understand about American politics and democratic majoritarianism or anything else fashion that Joe Biden does not?
So I actually continue to genuinely struggle, like have devoted a disproportionate amount of time to the question of what she does and doesn't understand. So I like it that that's how you phrased this question to me, because I can't answer it. She definitely doesn't. I do not share her baseline political commitments in terms of policy. I don't actually think that these voting rights bills are well crafted, nor do I think they will solve the problems they are meant to solve. And she supports them. She has said she supports these bills. But the speech that she gave last week was really good. And also the cool sweater she wore earlier in the week that was, I think, a dinosaur wearing a crown while she presided over the chamber was really good. And I just think that she alone seems to be correctly calibrating the level of seriousness with which what is going on the Hill should be treated. And I know that I am virtually alone in that assessment. So her speech last week, she said, listen, we are really, 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 really polarized right now. And getting rid of the filibuster and these other associated process reforms that people are trying to push through in the name of these voting rights bills is going to make that worse. And she is correct about that. Many people thought that the tone of her speech was wrong. She, you know, she definitely
she was a little tremulous.
It had some manifesto vibes. I would argue that if we are talking about speeches that were tonally wrong this week, that Joe Biden's speech in Atlanta was absolutely wild. I mean, those passages that you read, Matt, were just a taste. My personal favorite was, today we come to Atlanta, the cradle of civil rights, to make clear what must come after that dreadful day when a dagger was literally held at the throat of American democracy. What? What is happening? And the two speeches were, I think, a perfect pairing. She said, we are being too polarized. We are being too, you know, we are caricaturing the other side. Process and rules exist for a reason, and that is to build systems where we can do laws that have broad support, that have consensus. Biden went full Manichaean. He was just like, this is a war of good versus evil, and that's all there is happening here. There is no other way to view this, and I think he's just profoundly wrong about that.
Suderman, there's been a lot of Biden whispering in the op-ed pages. Your close personal friends, David Brooks and Ezra Klein, doing sort of trying to tell him what's going wrong with this presidency. What I don't get is this. Why would you go down, first year of your presidency, your first year, you've got a Democratic majority, you're the president, you can maybe do something. Why would you go down and make such a Manichaean with us or against us lying in the sand type of thing on something that you know you're going to lose?
It's a good question. And I think the answer is partly that Biden has been completely captured by the left flank of the Democratic Party, which assumed that it owned the entire party. And they didn't think that they were even a majority within their party. They didn't think that they were an influence on the party. The left flank, the Bernie progressive AOC flank, has spent the last several years assuming that the entire Democratic Party apparatus was theirs, and that as soon as they won control in Washington, that they could use the Democratic Party apparatus to do whatever it is they wanted. And Joe Biden, while a moderate in many ways and someone who campaigned on a return to normalcy and bipartisan deal making and all of that stuff, Joe Biden is, as you have said, Matt, a rusty weather vane. What he has always done is find the center of the Democratic Party and then just pursue their agenda. He's never been somebody who actually leads the party. What he's been is a point person for whatever the Democratic Party is on about on any given day. And so because Joe Biden is in many ways a weak president who is surrounded by a strong and demanding progressive faction, he has been in some ways powerless to resist their demands. And so in the process, I think he's just failed on the promise of Joe Biden. If you want to understand his crashing approval ratings, it's because Joe Biden promised a calm, you know, bipartisan approach to policymaking, right? Not turning up the temperature, turning it down. He promised a return to normalcy on COVID as well, right? And that just hasn't happened. And so after, you know, Trump's manic and divisive presidency, Biden has pursued an agenda that doesn't even have the full support of Biden's own party, right? The reason that these bills have failed and will continue to fail is not because of the filibuster, and it's not because of intransigent Republicans. It's because elected Democrats, most notably Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema, but also I think some others who have been quieter in their resistance, have said they don't support his plans and have refused to vote for them. And so Democrats under Biden are trying to govern as if they have a commanding, overwhelming majority, when what they actually have is the slimmest possible majority and a majority that, well, totally legitimate, is actually something of a fluke. Because if you remember, the only reason that Democrats have 50 seats in the Senate is because they won two upset victories in Georgia Senate runoff races earlier in this year. And those races, when we went into them, were heavily favored for Republicans. And there is at least some evidence to suggest that the only reason Democrats won those is because Trump's tirades about the vote being rigged convinced enough Republicans to stay home that Democrats ended up winning both of those seats. And so Democrats have this very slim majority that they won, like I said, not illegitimately, but on something of a fluke. And they are just bizarrely using it. They're attempting to use that very slim majority to govern as if they have a completely overwhelming mandate from the voters, which they just don't have. And Joe Biden is paying a political price for it.
Nick, as voters seem to be turning away from Biden and his party and turning towards Republicans in this midterm-ish off year, you know, I've been consuming Democracy in Peril journalism probably overly much so that the rest of you don't have to. But the underlying thesis of all of that is that this, you know, this could be the last election and that voters are doing this because of you know, inherent embrace or in Biden's own terms of autocracy. Do you think that these voters are consciously or even subconsciously, unconsciously, whatever, choosing autocracy, reconsciously choosing autocracy over democracy by going more Republican than Democrat?
I really, I hate to pull a Joe Biden on you, but I think I kind of spaced out there, Matt. I don't know. Like autocracy, democracy, premocracy.
Can you call Ron Klain to answer for
saying,
you?
Yeah, he can just like tweet a chart and it'll be fine.
We're not even supposed to be having a podcast.
But, you know, you were saying this is like, why is Joe Biden in the first year of his presidency doing blah, blah, blah? He doesn't think it's the first year of his presidency. He has like, how many years left does he have, Matt? He's got to swing for the fences. And he's actually done pretty well, and not in terms of completing things. I don't think the policies are good, but he has, you know, he has been a transformational president so far in terms of spending, both in terms of sheer dollar amounts as well as, you know, ratcheting up the social welfare state in a substantial way that is going to be really hard to pull down. You know, and he's following Trump, et cetera. I think what is going on, and I know I've talked about him a lot. When I think what is going on is the dynamic described by Stanford political scientist Morris Fiorina, which we are in an era of a period of no decision, which is resonant of the late 19th, early 20th century moment where neither major political party, neither national party could build a majority that had more than a couple of votes to spare. And what has gone on, he's talked about this, you know, starting in the 21st century. The parties have sorted fully into a liberal version and a conservative version of themselves. The people who are in the parties are more extreme than the modal members of their party. And Matt, as the co-author and possibly the co-reader of the Declaration of Independence, you recognize that fewer and fewer people are identifying with as parties, you know, in either the, as a Republican or a Democrat. The people who are in office from those parties are to the extreme edges. The people who are actually running the parties are even more extreme. And they all feel with some urgency when they get in power, they've got to shoot the works because they're going to get voted out in two years, 4 years, or 6 years, which is exactly what's been happening for the past 20 years and is about to happen in 2022. I think it's great that Americans are saying, fuck the Democrats right now. The only problem with that and with them is that then that means they're embracing Republicans who are going to get in office and do exactly the same thing in the same way that Trump and the Republicans did in 2016 and then got some of their asses kicked in 2018. And then, as Catherine was pointing out, I guess it was Catherine or Peter, you know,
indistinguishable.
The Democrats shouldn't even own the Senate. Yeah, you know, it's like I just see blurs on a screen. And, you know, since I don't see race or gender or class, you know, yeah, you guys are indistinguishable. But, you know, the Republicans gave up the Senate because Trump is an idiot. And so what we are just merely in the next kind of spin of the Wheel of Fortune, going back to the Republicans who will gain a majority in Congress, probably both houses, certainly the House, maybe get elected, win the White House in 2024 and then be bounced to the curb in 2026.
Are you guys excited for Republicans to win back the House so we can have impeachment proceedings against Joe Biden?
This is the real, issue for me is that this is wearying beyond belief. It's, friends, I am exhausted by partisan politics. Everybody is. And it's, I don't know what is the seismic shift, what is the natural disaster, what is the horrible economic reset, cultural reset that actually gets
it's
us
the
off
great
this timeline
reset
and into something.
Never forget.
It might be something good. It could be.
War with Russia is not going to be good, Catherine.
No, the Great Reset in the 90s was the collapse of the Soviet Union, and the rise and I guess actually even more important, and because that could have gone poorly, the rise of the internet and of the tech sector that that changed things and it made
Catherine,
it a great
so it's going to be the metaverse.
No.
Metaverse.
It's going to be, the Omicron wave crests and we all wake up and go, oh, what was that? And then we start partying.
No, that'll recede, but that brings us to a clearing, but it doesn't tell us what kind of settlement we're going to build.
We got to wait till they turn the chips on from the vaccines.
That is true. Catherine.
That's true. I do think, if I may, Matt, what could be good is if some of the breakthroughs in energy and whatnot, like if we get to a point where energy is essentially abundant and clean and free or near free, that's going to be a huge game changer. There's already a ton of, biomedical advances. Those things, we got a lot to look forward to.
Catherine. Following up on Nick's either realistic nihilism or nihilistic realism, and referring back to what Peter was saying about the kind of Biden promise of a return to normalcy and science-based COVID, whatever, and competent management, does his failure to deliver those things, does that say more about him or more about the unattainability, the unrealisticness of that as a goal, man?
I think that it definitely tells us that putting the right person in charge doesn't solve our problems. That's what I take away. Even if Joe Biden was the right person to be in charge, which he is not, there's still only so much that an individual can do, even in the presidency, to change the way things are going. And this is, we talked last week, 2 weeks ago, about this totally false conceit that presidents can magic jobs out of thin air and that they get credit for what the stock market is doing or blame, that they can will supply chain crises to end or begin, that they should, merit or accept blame for those things. This is all just a misunderstanding of the powers of the presidency. The president is very powerful, too powerful, but still not that powerful. Joe Biden sitting down at the Resolute desk and being a stumble bunny who people kind of want to have a beer with is not enough to return us to normalcy. We are still in the middle of a pandemic. There is still a great deal of disorder in the world, both kind of geopolitically and economically, and to somehow hope that Biden was going to do that was already misguided. And then he didn't choose to do that. He did not, in fact, prioritize those things. Perhaps understandably, he prioritized a bunch of major policy initiatives, which Peter has just described. But
most of which were Democratic priorities before the pandemic.
Right. And there was some don't waste a crisis going on for sure. But He didn't prioritize unity, his inauguration speech, notwithstanding.
He prioritized unity within his party.
Right, but that's not the same thing.
That Joe Biden has always misunderstood is that America isn't the Democratic Party.
Yeah, that's true. Actually, I think that's a pretty good way to sum it up. And I think that's one reason that followers and partisans of Biden are so especially mad at Sinema and Manchin. Because they aren't prioritizing the fate of the Democratic Party or the unity of the Democratic Party. They are prioritizing something else. And yeah, if you have already conflated those two topics, then you find their behavior baffling and enraging. And that certainly is the case in, you know, my non-libertarian friend circles. People are so mad at the idea that not going along to get along with your party, you know, could even be a possibility for these senators.
Even as I'm sure they love the renegade Republicans, right, who voted against Donald Trump or voted in favor, like those are real statesmen, right? That Matt, you, if I am not mistaken, and I don't think that I am, you wrote a whole book on the maverick John McCain. The love that, you know, the establishment or legacy media had for him was precisely that he would be willing to shit in the Republican punch bowl on a regular basis.
It's a very nice image. Thank you for it in the morning. Peter, what is the corrective or is there a corrective mechanism within the Joe Biden weather vane complex
we have to stab it with a rusty dagger
to make
Monkey
him
glands.
Realize that that doesn't work, what he did this past week, and that he needs to set things kind of in a different direction. Are there people around him who have any influence or pull that can go in that direction? Or do you think that the capture is kind of too much? Does he have any, does he have enough sort of internal balance that he can recognize it himself? Like, okay, hold on. Corn Pop over here is gonna right the ship. What is a way out for him aside from just taking the medicine that's gonna come his way in November?
One answer to this question is I don't think there is a solution. Another answer is that if there is a solution, it is what you said. It's the people around him. This is in low level practical terms, right? This is a very high level problem with like the structure of American politics and like Joe Biden himself and like all the weird incentives in the presidency and all that stuff. But if there's a very specific practical way to solve Joe Biden's problems right now, it's staffing. And Joe Biden basically took the off-the-shelf staff that liberal activists in Washington had prepared for him and made them the White House. And so, you know, Catherine is right. The president is very powerful, and the presidency is very powerful, but the presidency is not just one person. The presidency is a bunch of people. And in particular with Joe Biden, it seems pretty clear to me based on conversations with people who are, let's say, in that orbit, that Joe Biden, while in some ways he's a very powerful politician, he is also a relatively weak president. And his weakness is that the staff is making a lot of decisions for him or influencing him in certain directions. And you can see that just in his speeches. Do those speeches that he has been giving over the past year, these strident, divisive speeches about how, you know, basically Republicans are the enemy, do those sound like affable Joe Biden that we have known for the last 30 years? Who's not a great guy, who's not like somebody who we should, you know, be like, oh, he's so wonderful. But do they really sound like him? No, what they sound like are, they sound like quite left liberal op-eds, which are the sorts of things that that the staffers for a Joe Biden administration writes. And so that's, I think, the most visible public sign of it. And so if Joe Biden wants to fix this problem, he needs to fix his staffing problem, and he needs to start making decisions about who is going to be influential around him and who is going to be empowered to make decisions and to consult with him and that sort of thing. Because what he has done, like I said, is just take the Democratic Party staff apparatus off the shelf and say, well, we're the presidency now with me at the head of it, right? I am the Democratic Party. Remember that line? Okay, sort of a little bit he's the Democratic Party, but in some ways, the Democratic Party is president right now, and Joe Biden just happens to be sitting in the chair.
We had a whole staff conversation about the whether the ticket is Cinema Mansion or Mansion Cinema, and someone noted, well, they've been
the dream ticket in 2024, right?
Yeah.
Independent.
The end of the third, the bull moose, whatever. Yeah. But, you know, arguably, we are currently experiencing the Cinema Mansion presidency because they are at the very least, doing most of the deciding about what legislation goes through. Now, not technically the role of the president, et cetera.
So they're deciding the legislation, but the president is deciding an awful lot of other stuff because the president controls the bureaucratic and regulatory apparatus.
I think that you guys are conflating. Joe Biden is an unpopular president. He is not a weak president. He ran on a campaign on a platform that the Washington Post said was the most liberal of any Democratic nominee in history. And he is delivering on every goddamn aspect of it. This is a guy who talked about how Republicans, when he was Obama's vice president, Republicans were going to put black people back in chains. This is a guy who was, you know, during the Bork hearing way back in, you know, the 1880s or the 1780s or whenever that took place. He was a absolute, partisan to
when
the
you
max.
Were middle aged.
If I was lucky, you know, I don't even remember. I'm just hoping that my infections were middle aged in the 80s. He has been a partisan hack his whole time. He lives in a political arena that he has totally morphed into and is comfortable in, and Republicans do this too. The point of politics is to shove as much shit down the throat of your opposition as possible with as slim a majority as possible. I mean, Donald Trump got elected, you know, without a popular vote. So did, the first time around, so did George Bush. And that doesn't mean, oh, well, I don't have a mandate, so I'm going to be a unity candidate. We are in a particular age of having one extra vote and then ramming through as much stuff that is going to completely, catalyze the opposition to get into power and do exactly the same thing with smaller and smaller representation of the public at large. So I think Joe Biden is unpopular, but I wouldn't mistake that for him being weak or him not knowing what's going on. He's setting the agenda and he's following through, and it's a crappy agenda.
Well, he's weak in the sense that he's always been weak, which is that he like I said, he's the point person for whatever the Democratic Party's priority is at a given moment, whether that's criminal justice in the 1990s or the stimulus under President Obama. And so he is not an agenda setter himself. He is someone who takes the party's agenda and then says, this is what we're doing.
Nick, I was hearing a lot of callbacks to Real Man of Genius. I should do a reasoned search on that phrase.
Well, I felt like in the Atlanta speech, you could feel the pull between whatever, like the speechwriter who just like gulped down the Kool-Aid and then wrote this like heroic speech that they genuinely thought was going to be reprinted in full in history books. And then Joe Biden just like pulling on these fancy schmancy words, trying to be Joe Biden. Like he kept adding curse words to the speech, which was exactly not the tone of the speech. And, you know, I think like that's real. That's what's going on. It's like there are a lot of people in the executive branch, in the White House, with Biden's ear, in Congress, who really do think this is a battle of good versus evil. This is a battle for the soul of America. I think they're wrong. I think Joe Biden might think they're wrong, too. But he just...
That's the soft bigotry.
I fully, fully.
You're patting grandpa on the head.
To having low expectations in this case, yes.
Yeah. You know, and again, though, and I do think it's worth, you know, underscoring, though, that that good versus evil, you know, George Bush quoting the Bible, quoting Bob Dylan on Slow Train Coming, you know, after 9/11, he said, you're either with us or you're against us. This is, you know, from a gospel where Jesus says, you are either with me or against me. There's no middle ground. And we are in a Manichaean period in politics. And it's easy to say, oh, it's always like that. But it really, really is. No, there are times where there is more consensus or where one party is weak enough where it has to go along and unity is sought after on some level. But that has not been the case. Virtually all, with the exception of the Patriot Act in the 21st century, all of the big, big, massive legislation, for the most part, you know, whether it's Obamacare or whether it's various kinds of, Trump tax cuts or Biden stuff, you know, tends to be
the bipartisan infrastructure bill was bipartisan.
We are definitely,
and that is one of Biden's biggest accomplishments.
Not
this year.
Only against our halftime break, but we're in a, I think, an extended period of political political apocalypticism.
Polarization.
That's been with us at least the last 7 years in an intensifying way. It's Flight 93 elections all the way down. And I would just, watch how media establishment elitists, media treat any Republican victories, one of which we're going to be talking about after we deal with our listener email. But even before we get to listener email, as listeners of the Roundtable know all too well, the thing that we label health insurance does not, in fact, always pay for the full amount of medical bills during an emergency, especially for transportation. Even with so-called comprehensive coverage, you can still get hit with a huge deductible, copays for your trip to the hospital. That is where Air Medcare Network steps in. When you join Air Medcare as a member, if an emergency arises requiring transportation by air, you will not see a bill when flown by a provider. This peace of mind is available for your entire household, beginning at the low, low price of just $85 a year. People who do use this stuff, AMCN provides emergency transport for more than 100,000 patients a year. As a listener to this very show, you can get, along with your new membership, a $50 Visa or Amazon gift card. Just visit airmedcarenetwork.com/reason and use the offer code REASON and start protecting your family. Do it today. You'll be glad you did. All right, reminder, please send your pithy queries, that's a TH, to roundtable@reason.com, preferably with how you wish to be identified and a pronunciation guide for your illiterate host. This here letter comes from Vanessa, who says a bunch of really nice things about Peter's substitute hosting performance that I won't bore anybody with, and then gets to...
No, read them, Matt.
Nope. Then gets to the question. My fellow social studies teachers and I have created a media literacy unit for our 7th graders, but we're struggling to winnow down the endless topics and skills that fit in this category. We can also tell some stuff is too complex for that age group, so I'm curious what y'all think would be the most important topics or skills to cover in a unit like that. Catherine, your firstborn is 7th? 6th? Where are you at?
Not quite.
5th?
Yeah. Not quite there yet.
Yeah. But. Okay. So what is your syllabus? How do you winnow it down, Catherine?
So I did actually do a career day visit to my son's class, who is younger, a couple years ago. But they were at that time in, I guess they were in kindergarten or maybe first grade. And so I understood my audience. And what I did was bring little notebooks for them. And I told them that articles should be interesting and true. So that's what I would do for a younger group. For 7th graders, I actually would say just a wee bit of statistical literacy. Like, I actually think if you're going to give them one tool to understand whether an article is good, to understand how to evaluate sources, to understand what they are reading, just like some very, very simple statistical tools, which could literally just include like understanding how to use percentages. Some full-time working journalists who I will not name on this podcast still struggle with some of those concepts. And
Only 114% of the time.
And yet they are truly accessible, I believe, to 7th graders. So I would say just like some very, very basic how to understand the use and abuse of statistics in popular journalism would be a good exercise you could do with 7th graders.
Dr. Gillespie?
Yeah. When reading this article, it reminded me of something I wrote in Reason in 1995. And it's more than, talking about journalism per se. Like, media literacy is absolutely it's everything right now. Everything we do comes through screens, it comes through, published works, et cetera. So you have to develop a bullshit detector. That's good. In the 90s, I was talking about how television was at a moment when cable TV was going national and huge, and people were worried about the, just the onslaught 24/7 of the information overload
news cycle
between the web, which was growing. Yeah, no, and it's, sure, there were 57 channels, with nothing on, Matt, but there was just so much noise. How do you cut through that? And what was interesting is in the 90s, there was definitely a moment, and this includes South Park, it includes The Simpsons, it includes Beavis and Butthead from the late 80s into the 90s, Mystery Science Theater 3000. What you see is, you know, the medium that is becoming dominant as a kind of information source and as a reality teaches people how to read it critically. And that's all about that. And I think nowadays, you know, when you go to TikTok, when you go to Instagram, when you go to Reddit and things like that, the types of videos that are, you know, everywhere are mocking the conventions and the shorthands of knowledge, you know, that appear on those things. So I don't worry about this too much in a general sense, other than to say, you know, focus on bullshit detectors and realize that when you, you know, when you tell your parents a version of a story, it's motivated reasoning. It's you're sharing information designed to get a certain response, and you'll venue shop, you know, from parent to parent. Keep that in mind, because that's what people are doing to you when you're watching something, whether it's a narrative or a nonfiction. I like what Catherine talks about in terms of basic stats. One of the, you know, just a very specific thing is that if kids are reading something or if they're listening to something, just find a source for every statistic that is given and then see like whether or not the trend lines, you know, if it's given in percentages, find out what the raw numbers are. If it's given in absolute numbers, what's the percentage? What's the growth? What's the shrinkage? What are the trend lines? But, you know, it's look at the media that is most popular among kids and then seek out the versions of that that are parodying it and then thus showing you the way that the game is played.
Yeah, I think there's definitely something to be said for like explicitly doing a bullshit detector training program. And that's both through parody. And also, I think you could probably put together, maybe even just by like having the kids shout them out in the classroom kind of thing. Like, what are a bunch of phrases that should make you suspicious? Like, studies show is a great one. Science says anything that, you know, is like increased by 800%, like from what base. I think you could probably teach them the rule about, you know, if the headline ends in a question mark, the answer is no. Like, I think there's like a quick cluster you could build that would be potentially like lifelong useful for kids that age.
Suderman.
And I think also turning it on yourself, though, and saying like getting kids, actually, this would be good for everybody. What are your most cherished beliefs? What are the things you want to be true? And then find stories that debunk them, because
Suderman, Computerman,
we all do that.
I would start by just teaching seventh graders who are going to be like 12 years old or something like that to learn the difference between an opinion piece and a news piece in a major newspaper.
Ooh,
that
luck.
Puts you like so far ahead of most readers of journalism.
So you're talking about reading stuff from 100 years
and
ago.
I would say really focus on the major newspapers for that, because those those differences are a little fuzzier in an opinion magazine like Reason, but there are real firewalls between news and opinion in major newspapers, although I think they've become a little bit more muddled recently, especially with articles that are labeled, that come from the news section, but are labeled analysis. Which often just means this is opinion, but we work for the news side.
I feel like you just talked me out of your first thing there. Like, you know, like, teach them the difference between these things. Actually, that difference doesn't exist anymore.
The difference does exist, but it's also a little more complicated than it might seem. And so understanding that, I think, is useful. The second thing I would say is learn to understand the sourcing of facts and assertions. So all articles, whether they are newsy or whether they are opinion pieces or whether they are analysis, they all contain facts and assertions. And so understanding where those facts and assertions come from is, I think, in some ways the most important thing for people reading the news and reading journalism, right? So just to ask the question, where does this fact come from? Is an assertion made in a quote coming from a lobbying shop or an activist group? Is the study behind this fact actually reliable? Have other people commented on it, right? Just understand where facts and assertions are coming from in news articles. And finally, I would say that if you're teaching media literacy, don't just teach old forms like newspapers. Teach Wikipedia, which, you know, when I was in high school was taught as like absolutely unreliable. And now there are studies show Studies show that Wikipedia is actually much more reliable than a lot of other sources. And it's just super helpful and useful, like for understanding the breadth and depth of any subject. But examine YouTube essays and TikTok pieces on the news. Go through comments sections and like talk about the ways that comment sections actually like can provide you both with a lot of information and also like drive you completely mad at the same time. And then apply those lessons from the first two exercises where you're learning to understand sourcing, as well as learning to differentiate between news and opinion. Apply those to new and novel forms where that may not have the kind of old, you know, firewalls between news and opinion or the sorts of sourcing rules that major newspapers have.
I just feel like I took a long ride on the edge of a Mobius strip, man.
Yeah. Now, and also, like, forget the mainstream media. Come on. It's all
here's
press,
what,
Matt. Weren't you a war blogger? I mean, have them read old war blogs.
That's how you start to understand
that's good,
anything.
That's good reading right there.
I would add to this, these recommendations. Do a media literacy about the media business in two aspects. One is audience. What do people actually right now consume? And how many of them do that? And this is a recommendation to adults, including a lot of people who cover the media for a living, because there's a tendency to think that what happens on Fox News or MSNBC is really super important when the most watched program of all those gets maybe 3 million viewers a night, whose median age is 117. That's a scientific fact. And that's different than the size of the country. That's different than the size of the audience for the network, evening shows, local news, newspapers, whatever. So like sorting through that and it will open people's eyes about how that works. And then also which journalism entities and companies and whatever, what is the size of their business and their audience and their newsrooms? That also can open up some eyes and make people think about how they read stuff. Okay.
Can I say one more thing?
Yes, you
can. I know that we've talked on this for a long time, but it's a really good question, actually. I think seventh graders only care about peers. They only care about their friends. Basically, like, nothing that you do matters as a social studies teacher in seventh grade, I assume. So, like, thank you for your question. But also, like, your job sounds super, super hard. So maybe one possible thing to say is, like, encourage your students to make a friend that disagrees with them about at least one thing politically or, you know, in current events. Including maybe just even like, are the Kardashians good or not? Like, I don't know. I don't think it has to be politics, but, you know,
or
speaking of Manichaean,
are the Kardashians good?
I think so. But like, just speaking of people being overly Manichaean and polarized, like, hey, consider talking with someone who disagrees with you, who you respect, like figure out a way to do that because maybe that will help your brain be better.
I would last add on that is work backwards from the question, what is the thing that you learned about the world on either TikTok or Instagram or whatever else the kids are looking at nowadays? And why do you know that's true? Like, just search that one thing, go backwards from there. And that could be an interesting exercise. Lord knows my eighth grade daughter has tried to teach me a lot about the world that maybe I know a little bit more about than she does about things that she knows more about the Kardashians.
Hey, you know, Matt, don't drag that garbage pail into the reason around it.
Listen.
You know, if your daughter is smarter than you, you just live with it. Okay?
I can't. I won't. I shan't. All right.
The children are the father to men.
We are not going to devote a long topic on this, but we're going to devote a short topic on this. Over the weekend, Virginia Governor Glenn Youngkin was finally sworn in. Felt like he was elected about 17 years ago, but he was sworn in over the weekend, and he's someone who came into office kind of a surprise. We've talked about that election a couple of times on this podcast. Here he came out swinging with a dozen or so executive orders, including one that Robbie Suave has already written about this morning, banning school districts from making masks mandatory on students. The DC suburban districts of Arlington and Alexandria immediately said, no, they're not going to do that. So the conflicts are all beginning. Catherine, I'm just going to let you go solo here until at least Nick tries to interrupt. Since you're a Virginia mom, tell us about your feelings about this.
technically not a Virginia mom, but right. So we are like elbows deep in everything that is not forbidden is mandatory at this point in every direction. And, you know, I don't know what to do about it anymore. I think that, you know, we already kind of have been through this in Florida with the question of which kind of authoritarianism is worse, the kind where we allow local tyranny or the kind where we ban local tyranny to the extent that people have no autonomy, even in small community units. In this case, people seem to be hell-bent on misunderstanding whether this is a ban on mask wearing or a ban on mask mandates, just as we have been collectively hell-bent on misunderstanding the distinction between mask wearing and mask mandates all across this country at every level for the last 2 years. Kids are still welcome to wear masks to school in Virginia. Just to be clear, like, Glenn Youngkin did not ban children from wearing masks in school. What he banned was school districts making their own decisions. I don't love that, actually. I don't think that's probably the way forward. I would, you know, but I do think this is here always forever, really a case for school choice. School choice doesn't solve this problem completely, right? Because you could still have a situation where you say your charter will be revoked if you do or don't follow whatever garbage mask mandate exists at whatever level. You do not get a full solution to these problems. I do think, though, you maximize the possibilities for a more tolerant and pluralist system. The more that we have practice tolerating different educational and behavioral and disciplinary practices within different types of schools in the same district, I think the argument that we are about to now see totally inverted is going to be about curriculum management, right? He's also banned CRT. That's going to be, you know, just as much of a problem. Again, where, at what level should these decisions be made? A tricky question. Should it be that one dude decides for the whole state and then everyone eats each other's faces off? Probably not optimal. Could your children still read the 1619 Project, even if it's not taught in schools? Definitely yes, just to be clear. We're not burning those books. So that was, I guess, all just a sort of slightly rage-fueled way of saying that this conversation really couldn't get any dumber. And yet here we are in an even more intractable fight about it. And that at least a couple of parents in the Arlington-Alexandria systems who are on Reason's staff are now in a really sticky place where they have a state law, they have a local mandate, and they have their own personal preferences, and all three of those are pulling against each other, and there is no good way forward. And this is all about a population that is the least at risk and has already borne the greatest costs.
One small contention with your answer there. I think this will get dumber.
Ugh.
You know, but it is worth pointing out that Youngkin here is acting incredibly hypocritically. I mean, he, you know, if he is in fact a, you know, let's let local people decide things, or pushing, you know, devolving power down to the smallest jurisdiction and things like that. And he's doing that with CRT. And conservatives need to work out a better argument where they're going to say, you know what? We should let, you know, states and counties and, you know, towns, et cetera, decide everything, except when we really, really want everybody to do something the way we want.
Also notable, though, that many of the people who are opposed to Youngkin's order believe that it's perfectly fine for a governor to mandate that all schools in the state require masks.
Yeah.
Such as New York.
Youngkin's changing the law. That's all I'm saying. That's all I'm saying. And it's a problem with conservatism. And Youngkin is, you know, he's also signed a law, or he's pushing to open 20 new charter schools in Virginia. I think libertarians in particular should be holding his feet to the fire to actually be an apostle and an evangelist for real school choice, not nickel and diming around the edges and then doing statewide mandates about CRT and mass in one way or the other. The way forward, ultimately, even though it's going to make a world where everybody is annoying, is to let, you know, is to devolve power to smaller and smaller units of governance.
One point that Robbie Suave made this morning and Youngkin made, and I think that is true, is just that the CDC guidance on which the mask mandates have been laid in Virginia and in New York, where I live, are not based on good science. Something Jacob Sullivan has written about many, 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 many times, and the CDC and its director has misstated that science serially and badly. And if you happen to live in a place with a certain type of politics, that means in January of 2022, 2-year-olds have to wear more strong masks than they did in December. And that is something that's increasingly difficult for some people and those kids, including my own, to deal with. It's just not fun to wear the mask here in year two. Okay. Or year three, even almost. We're getting there. So let's go to our end of podcast, what you have been consuming in the cultural sphere. Peter Suderman, do you want to lead us off?
Yeah, I watched The Expanse season 6, the final, maybe, season of this show, which is a science fiction series about a sort of three-way clash in the solar system between Earth, Mars, and the Belt. So people who live out in the asteroid belt and sort of mine the resources that keep the planets alive. From there, the ways that humans move out beyond our solar system into the rest of the galaxy. And so the first 3 seasons were on the Sci-Fi channel, and then this it was canceled, and it was picked up by Amazon, which has run 3 seasons since then. I thought seasons 4 and 5, which were the first 2 seasons on Amazon, were really the best that this show has had to offer. Just kind of smart, political, but also really plot and character driven science fiction, in which every single character, save for one, is extremely consistent. You don't have any of these reversals that are designed to like trick you by a character behaving in a way that is suddenly uncharacteristic, with the exception of the captain, who is kind of the main character of this of the show, whose whole character is that he makes decisions by his gut and he's somewhat unpredictable, and that's sort of how the show keeps a lot of the suspense going. But it's a smart show about politics and factions and governance the ways that people sort of band together and self-organize to build societies. I do think season 6 was somewhat weaker, in part because it was just 6 episodes. So the first 3 seasons on Sci-Fi were 13-episode seasons. Then when they moved to Amazon, the first 2 seasons were 10 episodes each. And the 6th season, the 6-episode season that we got here for season 6 just wasn't enough time, I think, to develop the ideas here. Still, it's a good show, a very satisfying science fiction show in a lot of ways. And for people who want something that is a little more realistic, a little more of a kind of hard sci-fi show, I strongly recommend it. Somewhat interestingly, it started as a custom role-playing, like tabletop board game by the 2 authors who wrote the book series that it is based on. And they realized that they had so much kind of story and plot and systems building already done that they could just convert this into a series of novels, which then, of course, became this television series. Pretty good show if you like nerd TV.
Nick, you like nerd TV. What did you watch or do?
Oh, I consumed, like a bottomless serving of lasagna, The House of Gucci. The new Ridley Scott movie that features Jared Leto, Lady Gaga, Al Pacino, and Adam Driver, among others. Jeremy Irons is floating around there. But what I love about this movie, and I urge all Americans to see it, but especially all Italian Americans, is that it is, whatever the subject matter, it is ultimately the triumph of America over old Europe, to resurrect one of Donald Rumsfeld's old phrases. It is about the fashion house of Gucci, which ultimately was, all of the Guccis were squeezed out because they were horrible pieces of shit. And it was resurrected by Tom Ford, the, you know, gay Texan nobody who ended up like just revamping and revitalizing fashion in the late 80s, 90s, and continues to do so. So in a way, it's about old European fashion being taken over by Texans of all subspecies of Americans. But then more importantly, it gives a raft of Italian-American actors the ability to do the most cartoonish mustache, Pete. What you talking about? Italian accents.
A lot of spicy meatballs in there.
In a prestige performance. It's all spicy meatballs all the way down. And Lady Gaga, you know, Jared Leto, Al Pacino, they are all great and so hammy. And it is just like, you know what? Italy, Europe, you had a great run. America is doing just fine now. And we'll use you as source material for what we want to do going forward. It's a really fantastic, massively long movie, but it's going to make you feel good about being an American in a time when, you know, America's
Catherine,
not
so what's making you feel good about being American?
Oh, the very opposite, my friend. I read The School for Good Mothers, which is a novel by Jessamine Chan. It's her first novel, and it's pink, and it has the word mother on it. And so I know that no men will ever read this book, and that's unfortunate because it is one of the best near future dystopias that I have read in a really, really long time. Here is the best way I can make a recommendation for this book. I went to the Amazon page to get a link to put in the notes of this podcast. By the way, you can always get all of our recommendations at the podcast page at reason.com or at the Reason Roundtable recommendations page where we collect them all. Anyway, I went to get the note from Amazon. I scrolled down to look at the reviews on Amazon, and you know who has the first most helpful 5-star review of this book on Amazon.com?
Russ Roberts.
Lenore Skenazy.
Oh.
Lenore Skenazy. She's just in there immediately just being like, this book is basically Lenore Skenazy's worst nightmare. It is, it starts out with a CPS case, sort of child protective services, called on an overwhelmed mother of a toddler. And you're like, okay, this is realism. This book takes place right now. And then it gets a little weird. And then it gets catastrophically, darkly weird to the point of horrific tragedy. I don't want to give anything away because it's the unveiling of this that is part of the pleasure of the book. I do not recommend, however, if you are a parent of young children, starting this book at like midnight. Don't do that because you won't sleep great for like a couple days. Really powerful, really good, really libertarian. Read this book, even though it's pink, please.
So you could read it on Kindle,
you know,
right?
That's the
recommendation.
The
read this book on Kindle.
Yeah, so you don't see the pink cover, so your manhood stays intact. Yeah. I don't know anything about the author.
Catherine,
it's
do you
her
know
first
anything?
Book. Yeah. It's clearly the protagonist is a thinly veiled alter ego of the author. We don't know. I don't
Sounds
know much
great.
About her. She has won. What I know is that she has won all the writing prizes already, but this is her first novel. And it does have the very, very taut kind of short story feel to it. It is not a long book. And she has previously had some very successful short stories. So it has that kind of vibe.
Continuing the anti-recommendation at the start of my recommendation is in case you or your spouse it's that enough time has passed since the first time you saw Gremlins and you thought that'd be a good family movie night for the 6-year-old, I'm here to say that's probably not a great idea. Just to throw that out there. The thing that I saw that it's more appropriate for six-year-olds, and that was pretty great, flawed but great, is Encanto, which is the Disney animated feature that their 60th that came out last year, made a bunch of money. You probably didn't notice it if you're not a parent. And it's sort of, I think, even, you know, with 2 days separated from it, you start to see all kinds of holes in it. But it's about a family that in Colombia somewhere fleeing political violence. And spoiler alert. And it's a young mother with triplets, and then the father, and then the bad guys are coming. And so the father, he dies, and then the magic candle magically makes the matriarch and the family propagate.
Are you trying to sound like a six-year-old?
He's doing a great job. This is what this movie is like. Yes. This is correctly conveying the movie.
And it's
what does the magic candle do?
It helps build.
I want to know.
Builds a magic house, and everyone in the family has magic except for the one girl who doesn't have the magic, and so you can imagine how things go there. It's very lush and beautiful, kind of magical realist. It's fun, but the songs are great, and it's written by this guy who I'm not familiar with his work. Literally, I'm not. But I think he has a future in the musical theater. His name is Lin-Manuel Miranda. It's really good songs and like just a great fusion of a variety of things. And I like those a lot. And I've come to find out that six of the songs have made the top 100 on the Billboard charts.
They're also all just the same song Lin-Manuel Miranda always writes, and they're earworms and they're great. But there is a whole genre on TikTok right now, which is just people mashing up every Lin-Manuel Miranda song in each category and showing that you could sing the lyrics of Hamilton over the Encanto soundtrack with not nary a bobble in it, and that also you could throw the Moana song that he wrote on top of that and it still works. And you know what? If it ain't broke,
it's fine. Absolutely fine.
I mean, one thing about Shakespeare was that he used a different meter every time.
That's good. All right. That's enough iambic pentameter for one podcast. We'll be back next Monday. I won't be, but Peter will be doing his yeoman hosting work that people apparently like so much. And listen to all of our podcasts at reason.com/podcast. This would include the recent interview with Nick Gillespie, Dr. Nick Gillespie, and the Soho Forum debate series, Gene Epstein. And also, if you just really like Peter or anybody else or this podcast, consider giving a donation to our nonprofit that publishes all this stuff, reason.com/donate. You can even do it on a monthly recurring basis if you so choose. And that's it. Thank you very much. We will catch you next time, and goodbye.